Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we're talking about the history of cannabis activism, and we are joined by the founder of the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, Paul Stanford. Paul, thank you for being here with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. Good day.
It is a good day, and let's talk for a moment about Portland, Oregon, which we know is where you're located. How have the last couple of months been? How have you been hanging in there despite everything that's going on around the world?
Well, you know, we're still under a lockdown here. Portland was the last metropolitan area in Oregon to come out of that. Governor here has extended the no eviction policy, I think, through the end of September here. That just happened yesterday. Also, today, a drug legalization initiative to make drug treatment available for all people was certified for the ballot this November. But in terms of the COVID crisis, we haven't been as badly impacted as some. Our rates have gone up a little bit after the start of the reopening. It's kind of flattened out here currently.
Hey, Paul, talk a little bit, if you would, about that ballot measure, because Oregon, of course, has been extraordinarily progressive as it relates to cannabis, at least from an outsider's perspective, and enacting one of the nation's first adult use laws for the marijuana side of the industry, and has been a significant player in many respects, genetics in particular, and then some on the industrial hemp side of the industry. Tell us a little bit about that ballot measure and what your hopes are for it.
It's sponsored by the Drug Policy Alliance largely, and the local political action committee. It would decriminalize all drugs and set up treatment funded largely with marijuana taxes and some other tax sources. I haven't studied it in depth, so I really can't speak to all the details of it, but we're happy that it qualified. There's another initiative that hasn't qualified yet. They've been affiliated that would legalize, like Denver has, psilocybin therapy, so for people who want that. And so this would set it up on a statewide basis.
No, that's also exciting, and you know, would love to help in any way in that regard with our resources and the great Noah Potter is available to you as necessary on the psilocybin campaign. But you know, the topic of the show is the history of activism, and your efforts go back many years, and you've seen a lot, you've done so much. The question I always pose against that backdrop is, what happens when a movement becomes an industry? Because that's certainly what's happened on the marijuana side, but not just in the United States or in a particular state, around the world. But how do you view that? How do you view what happens when a movement becomes an industry?
Well, you know, inevitably, there are going to be a lot of changes, and the changes are going to be disrupting for many people, and that's inevitable when you change from, you know, a prohibition paradigm to, you know, the market. And then, and of course, next to regulation is always critical. Shiv said one thing, and the legislature traditionally in Oregon had a hands-off policy when it comes to new initiatives passed by the people. In this case, that went out the window. So it was the first time that the state immediately started altering the law. And some of those changes, and some of them have been bad. But we've seen a large and diverse mom-and-pop network spread up, and some of that's consolidating. We've seen fluctuation prices. Prices went really low here again, lower than any place nationally. Over the back now, which is good for the growers. And there have been a lot of, you know, capitalists have jumped in, and I personally have suffered a hostile corporate takeover, and basically based on lies and money. And so I've been victim of trying to take my company public. I think I was just set up, really. But a lot of other people have seen similar things, probably not as bad as I was. But the market continues to change. That's one thing we can all count on.
Well, Paul, if you don't mind, if you care, and if you're free to share, can you tell us a little bit about that scenario, or is that a subject of dispute or a subject that you can't necessarily get into?
So I could certainly talk about it. I had some people approach me, now know that they were really targeting me to take me out politically. They came in and offered to help take my company public. They didn't pay me anything. They said they would give us money to help put our initiative on the ballot to legalize marijuana in 2014. In fact, they never came up with that and used some fake documents to go into court and get a temporary injunction to take over my business in June of 2016. And they filed about 30,000 pages of documents. The judges seem to be paid off, actually, to be honest. One judge, in fact, Matarazzo, the local district attorney, said a few months after she granted their preliminary injunction that she was corrupt and that they weren't going to try cases in front of her again. So you know how rare that is, that a district attorney would call out a judge for being corrupt. She retired and went to work for the law firm that went after me. Apparently, these people spent $2 million. As I said, they filed 30,000 pages worth of documents. I spent about $170,000 on attorneys in the first 6 months. This legal battle went on from June of 2016 through April of 2019. In 2019, I was demanding a jury trial. I didn't have an attorney. I was representing myself. They moved to dismiss their case. I argued they shouldn't, but the judge allowed them to dismiss their case. And since they have all my assets, even real property that my nonprofit foundation owned outright, they just beat me with lawyers and money, even though they had lies and forgeries.
Well, Paul, was this
pretty incredible tale?
Was this the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or was this a different company?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it was the property belonged to the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, and it was a house where we'd grown medical marijuana for about 12 years, and so they took that. And because I didn't have an attorney, I just lost by default. In the clinic case, I had changed my clinic name over to Empower. And made it into a business instead of a nonprofit in about 2011. And so this was a business, it was Empower Healthcare. And so they took my company public. And the people who came in and did this are now four of the board of directors of the Kronos Group in Toronto. And as you probably know, last year, they brought in a $1.8 billion investment from Altria Group, which are the owners of Marlboro Tobacco. So the board of directors of Kronos are the ones who really did this to me. But they've taken my company public on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and they basically drove it in the ground, sold the medical records. They have one of my 12 different offices is still open here in Portland, competing with me.
Well, so Paul, that tale of woe is certainly something that we've seen in this industry. We've seen people taken advantage of, like yourself, folks that come in. You characterize them as capitalist folks that just have no objective but for money.
Predatory
capitalism at all costs. What is the lesson there? How can we provide some insight to our listeners about how to avoid that and how to protect themselves, how to carve out a role that would be appropriate.
Just be very, very careful who you're dealing with. In this case, I really didn't know who I was dealing with, and they made themselves apparent later on. And so I should have gotten better legal counsel earlier in this, and I didn't.
Well, as we look at what happens when a movement becomes an industry, another thing that we've seen is this has really gone global. In fact, you and I ran into each other recently, and I think it was the end of November 2019, back when we were allowed to travel. We were in Medellin, Colombia, at our good friend Henry's event, Expo Medovid, down there, and the Cannabis Congress that took place. Tell us a little bit about your impressions of the global side of this industry. And is that something that you're proud to see happen, or does it make you cautious and nervous for the same reasons?
Oh, no, I'm very happy. I'm very happy to see it happen. Even with the challenges, I'm still glad that we've legalized cannabis here in Oregon. I'm happy to see it progressing around the world. You know, it's really a culture. I know, and often speak on this, the oldest crop has been cultivated well over 25,000 years. And the most productive crop for food, fuel, fiber, pharmacy. So we need this plant. You know, we've co-evolved with it for 25,000 years. So I'm very happy to see. Vince, I met Henry first, I believe, in Santiago, Chile, and then in Uruguay at events there, Expo Weed in Chile and Expo Cannabis in Uruguay. And he asked me to come to the Expo MediWeed, and I'm honored to have gone to all four of them so far. It looks like this year's has been canceled. Is that what you've heard?
Yeah, unfortunately, Bob? Unfortunately, it does appear to be the live events are not going to take place. But we're all teed up for, I think, a strong 2021 as it relates to Henry's events and hopefully some others where we can get out in the world again. One of the things that occurs to me is as you see different countries attack this problem. And you know, the problem is not necessarily originated the same way it here is here in the United States. In the United States, to legalize cannabis, we've had to see citizens band together and stand up, and that takes the form of gathering signatures and initiating a ballot measure. It generally has not come from, in fact, almost exclusively has not come generated as a policy change by a government. There are some governments that have initiated it most recently, but the early states, and as you point out, Paul, to this very day, cannabis or drug policy reform has to occur through grassroots organization, policy reform initiated by citizens. And that's really the tale of, did the folks such as yourselves that pushed so hard for so long get what you anticipated in terms of legalization, or is this commercial environment not what was intended? Because we hear stories all the time about, you know, we should go back to the days of pre-commercialization and regulation, and or maybe we should have just gone for a decrim measure, decriminalization versus a regulated commercial environment because of all the challenges that we've seen and the predatory capitalism that is a result of it. Can you comment on some of those items?
Sure. Well, I think that we need to legalize cannabis, and that we aren't at the end stage yet. There's a lot of changes to come. I think that we've seen it overregulated here in the United States. There's this irrational fear of tetrahydrocannabinol, you know, THC, and that's a lot of times hemp is cultivated. Well, I guess almost exclusively it's cultivated according to its THC content. We shouldn't judge a seed crop for cannabis or a fiber crop for cannabis by its THC content. That shouldn't really matter. It should be the best cannabis available for seed and fiber. And so eventually, I think those changes will happen. We're seeing a lot of, you know, changes
currently with the Black Lives Matter movement and promises and changes in government. I think it's very important that some of those happen in the near future because, you know, they say artificial intelligence will become sentient in about 20 or 25 years. I think it's very important that people expand our individual rights before that happens. And I think cannabis is a bellwether issue when it comes to individual rights. And that's what got me involved in the initiative process back in the late 70s and early 80s. To make marijuana legal. It was because I saw that it was being used as a means to stop progressive change and to suppress minorities. And so I saw it as a key for future political freedom. And, you know, they say, Martin Luther King said, I believe, that the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. Well, we need to bend it a little bit more and a little bit faster, and I saw cannabis as being a critical issue. As I said, I think we co-evolved with it, and we need that evolution to continue. This symbiotic relationship between humans and cannabis is something that is desperately needed.
Very well said, Paul. And I want to come back to that thread on hemp and how hemp, we're overly focused on THC, particularly that shouldn't really be the concern when you're looking at grain and fiber. And to just go back 30, 40 years, I know that you helped Jack Herrera on his early versions of The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And maybe you could speak a little bit to the, I don't know, maybe what's on the horizon or shining light at the end of this. There's a lot of bad. There certainly is. And as Bob says, as the industry has moved from the movement space really to a commodity and an industry, there's certainly a lot of cautionary tales like your own. But what do you think Jack, for example, I guess, would be thinking today in 2020, seeing the Farm Bill passage and seeing the implementation of the IFR from USDA? Are we making good progress, or are we still stymied partially by our own I don't know, our own perspectives that are rooted in a lot of complicated issues?
You know, I know Jack would have been disappointed in this. I met Jack Herrera back in 1982 when I was in Los Angeles and met his partner, Captain Ed Adair, before I met him. And then we both moved to Oregon in 1984 to work on the Oregon Marijuana Initiative. And we qualified for a vote in 1985. That we lost the election a year later in November 1986. That was the second marijuana initiative that was voted on in the United States. The first was in California in 1972. But we lost with just 26% of the vote. The whole federal government came down on our heads there, where the Reagan administration, George Bush, Nancy Reagan, they came and campaigned against us there in 1986. But Jack wanted cannabis regulation to be along the lines of wine regulation. That's probably a better model than what we've seen actually implemented. He'd be disappointed with where we're at right now and be pushing for changes like the ones that we're talking about.
We've heard lots of discussions about how to approach cannabis legalization or cannabis reform at the federal level. Some folks talk about descheduling. Some folks talk about rescheduling. Some folks talk about the need to first change the UN Convention on Narcotics to properly reflect cannabis as something that is medicinally beneficial and adjusted accordingly on a global scale. What do you see as the preferred path for federal legalization of the marijuana plant in the United States?
Well, I think descheduling would be ideal. The preferred path is to see cannabis descheduled, taken off the schedule, so that federal regulation goes away and the DEA's control over this goes away. You know, they've already scheduled the THC synthetic Drapanol, Marinol pills down to Schedule 4 And so that's what I think the preferred path is, let the states regulate it. Then we can, just like they do with the alcohol industry.
No, that's very well put. As you think about folks that have worked for such a long time, such as yourself, to affect reform, the OGs, if you will, and that's an overused term, but it stands for a point. How do OGs participate in a commercial environment? Because it seems like, as you point out earlier, there are folks that are out there that are predatory in nature, less than honest in their business dealings, and all of a sudden, and whether this is here to stay or not is debatable, this is big business. And when there's a lot of dollars at stake, all of a sudden companies feel like they want pedigreed professionals from outside of cannabis to come in and run these businesses. Now, it's debatable whether those folks are qualified to be in that position, but how do the OGs reinvent themselves and participate in a way that would be meaningful in this industry going forward?
Change is inevitable, and so you've got to take it as it comes and try to influence it to the best of your ability and organize that influence with others. Right now, the best thing you can do is the other old adage goes, is to think globally and act locally and work in your local communities and state and local communities to enact the changes that are needed. And that takes a lot of legwork, a lot of time, but that's the way change happens. So I think that we've got to deregulate the cannabis industry and take away this fear of THC that permeates our culture. And part of that is educating people. More and more people are becoming educated every day. Things like this podcast are one way that happens. But it's a long process, as Martin Luther King said. It's a long arc of history. When I first got involved in this, I did not think, in the late 70s when I was a teenager, I thought marijuana would be legal by the early 1980s. And it never occurred to me that this would go on for so long. If I'd known that it was going to go on for so long, I'm not sure I would have been involved in it the way I was. But once I started becoming deeper and deeper into it, I saw that, that I thought this was the right path. And so I've continued on. I'm proud to have done what I've done. And, but there's more changes needed.
Well, it's certainly something to be proud of, and you've been extraordinarily impactful. Just one note on that, thinking that it's right around the corner. There's a book you may be aware of called The Marijuana Farmers, written by a professor from the University of New Orleans in the late 60s named Jack Fraser, not Jeff Fraser, but Jack Fraser.
Yeah. And got a cop.
He talks about, like you just said, just like Jack Hare wrote about, as you well know, but he talks about it at that point in time. It's just a year away. It's just 10 months away. And it was this notion that every time there was one step forward, it was three steps back because of the Reagan administration example you cited, or because of other folks that just didn't understand it, or because special interests try to suppress the legality of the plant. And continue to maintain these fictions that have been perpetrated for years and years and years. So it is, unfortunately, something that didn't come to fruition on the timeline that you had hoped, but it did come to fruition, albeit
that's right,
imperfectly.
And many of our friends didn't live to see that. There are a lot of my mentors that didn't live to see it, like Jack Kerr and Ed Adair and Todd McCurea and many, many others. Go unnamed, but we all knew that eventually we would prevail because the facts were on our side. So eventually the truth will win. And so it's a long process, but it's worth it, I think. Well, I think everything's accelerating now as well in terms of change. And it's critical that these changes for personal, individual freedom continue. And that's going to take a lot of input from people who believe that.
Just like yourself, Paul. we're certainly grateful to have you on the Hoban Minute, and even more grateful for the contribution that you have had for decades now and moving all of this forward. I think this conversation has been a reminder that every silver lining's got a touch of gray. It certainly has been for myself, but Paul, we thank you so much for coming on today, and we can't wait to talk
to
you.
Thanks for having
me. Yeah.
It's our pleasure.
You're welcome.
To see you on the road sometime soon, and be well out there, Paul. Thank you.
All right, you too. Travel safely. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law, and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.